Welcome to Songcatcher, right here on Radio Adelaide on digital, online, and 101.5 FM. I'm Claire here with Adrian and Clayton. We're missing Chen tonight. Billy on the panel, and we're just go, go, go.
Yeah, I've just actually hopped out of the freezer and defrosted myself personally.
I'm really excited about tonight's guest because this is something so different for us.
It is going to be so different. You know, Songcatcher is, after all, usually about catching up with songwriters and finding how they get up to and why they get up to. Tonight's guest isn't exactly a songwriter, but...
No, tonight we're wandering away a little bit more from the usual singer-songwriter type guest into more of the field of experimental soundscapes. Our guest tonight is... Oh, no. How am I?
Yeah.
Iran Sanazadeh.
Well done. Perfect.
Pretty good.
Who is a PhD candidate in musicology and sonic art. So I'm sure we'll learn a lot more about those topics.
Is that like
professors.
Jedi arts, Adrian?
I don't know.
Is it Jedi arts?
Yes.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. I mean,
I would
not that
say
far.
So. From what I've listened to, yeah.
Yeah. It's quite close, but, you know, in a sound way.
So how does Iran the person relate to Iran the country?
I'm from Iran the country.
You should probably.
And it still retains its name even though you've taken it away.
Well, you know, they didn't want me there, so it's... I guess I took the name with me.
So. Okay. Well, welcome along to here.
Thank you.
So you were born overseas in Iran?
Yeah. I was born and raised in Iran, and I moved here when I was almost 17. Yeah, so...
So old enough to make your own decisions in such things, or come over with family?
I came by myself. But my brother lived here until I was 18 and he no longer had to be my guardian and then he moved. So kind of by myself.
Wow. Big move.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit far away, but, you know, flights are good. It was a big move, though, because I was 17 and very comfortable. And Iran is very different from here, at least in the world that I was in.
So did you come to go to school or had you finished school?
I was in high school, like, almost done, but that was in 2009, and that's when all the unrest happened over the disputed election in Iran, and because of that and my family's political history, they thought it best that I don't follow their path, and they sent me very far away.
We welcome political rat bags in Adelaide. Don't worry about that.
So, yeah.
And we understand you're no stranger to Radio Adelaide, having worked previously on student radio.
Yeah. I used to have do a show called Brainstain in, I think, 2013.
So that would have been at the old building.
Yep, yeah.
I thought we had an embargo against student radio people coming on to Songcatcher. I mean, they do have a reputation.
Oh, no. I can believe it.
No, we like people to stir it up a little bit occasionally, and I think you're going to do that for us tonight.
Oh, I hope that's okay.
I think it's okay. I like it. I like a bit of stirring.
Okay, so you're now a PhD candidate. So just tell us a little bit about the study you've done to get to that point.
So I initially wanted to be a physicist for a long time. And then I think, you know, as all teenagers are trying to work out who they are, and it doesn't really happen for another like 10, 15 years after that. So I was obsessed with sound, but I didn't really feel like studying math anymore because I'd already... It was the difference between the education system here and there, and... So I decided to just learn how to play sound because I was a terrible musician when I was 16. I couldn't play anything and I never practiced. So then
but
I decided to
that's
do it.
An interesting thing because I just heard you wanted to play sound. You didn't want to play music.
No.
You wanted to play sound.
Yeah.
So that's a different thing as well for here.
So my brother is he's a musician of lots of instruments, but he was a drummer when I was a child, and being a younger sister, I wanted to do anything that he didn't do, and I hated everything he did. And so when he decided to be a very serious metal drummer, I decided I'm never going to play any rhythmic music because clearly it's for fools. So that is how I decided to play, you know, when I decided to do music, do different kind of stuff. And that was mostly because I didn't know how to play rhythmic music.
Well, Billy, as a drummer, will now shut down the rest of the program.
No, I think we should go straight into some music from that point, actually. So the first piece we've got?
Looks like it's If Then.
Oh.
Would you like to introduce that for us?
Of course. Happily to.
And don't tell us the time signature because it doesn't have any.
Yes. Well, I'm learning how to play music better now, a few years later. I built a physical interface for myself in my honors year because, you know, like I said, I don't know how to play any real instruments. So I built one for me, and it is controlled by movement, and the system is connected to a synthesizer, which I also built, and that has a memory. So it remembers how you move, like, your entire body and how the pressure on the instrument changes. It remembers that, then it translates into sound. So not only does it not have a time signature, when you play this instrument, you don't really have control of it either. So, that's essentially the idea, is to allow the instrument to do things for you.
How did we let you come in with recordings and not bring this in?
It's a bit. It's a wooden platform. It's quite big. It's about 2 meters by 2 meters.
Too big for the studio.
Oh, yeah. We could have done something, guys.
Yeah. Next time.
Well, so the first live of you've actually performed this live featuring dancers from the Australian Dance Theatre.
Yeah, yeah. We were doing a performance using this instrument, and they were also performing at that concert. And, you know, being an opportunist musician, I was like, oh, look, this is made for dancers. Would you like to move on this? It will play music for you. And they did an incredible job, and I was standing in the middle of them pretending that I was also useful. So this is that, I think, the recording of that performance.
And it's 8 minutes long, 8.5 minutes long, so we'll just take an excerpt from this, I believe.
Thank you.
And you're with Songcatcher, and you've been listening to If Then, a piece by Eran Sanadze. I just said it incorrectly, didn't I?
No, no, no. No, that was spot on.
You can't say it wrong.
No, really, you can't. There's so many syllables.
So that's pretty much a dance piece. So is there a visual of that on YouTube or something?
Yeah. On my website, there's the video of, I think, this performance. There's a link to it. And it's iran.sanad.net.au. Please go and check it
and
out.
How did you find the how did the dancers find doing that?
I think it was an interesting experience for both me and the dancers, because this instrument was actually inspired by a dancer who was based in Adelaide in the early 70s. She died when she was 25 in the mid 70s, and she was a pioneer in interaction design and building instruments, or these giant sculptures that helped dancers get control of sound, which happened much earlier than this whole movement of interaction design happened later on. And so I found her instruments, which were also wooden platforms that were controlled by movement. I wanted to use them, but they're heritage items because she's a pioneer and she's no longer with us, etc. So I built my own. But this performance ended up bringing me and dancers together, you know, much later, using an instrument that was inspired by the same kind of setup. And yeah, it was a very interesting experience for all of us, but
the dancers, of course, have been trained and practiced dancing. They hadn't really had much practice on this platform. I shouldn't call it a platform. What do you call it? It must be an instrument. It must have a name.
I just call them my floors. Because they're floorboards. They're about, 20 centimeters tall. They're platforms, and they're wooden. They're completely wooden.
And it's quite linear in terms of you move on them, or are they?
Yep. Yeah, okay. And they can take a lot of different pressure, so I can jump on them, I can do a handstand. I can't do a handstand, but if I could, I would do a handstand on them.
With help, you could.
Yes, with help.
What happens if you fall over on them?
Nothing happens to them. A lot would happen to me.
What kind of a sound is produced? Yeah, mm-hmm. What kind of sound is produced if somebody falls on them?
Then we would actually hear the wood, because all of the sound that you actually hear is it's synthesized. So I can attach any sound to their motion, and I can program that however I like, which for me is too much control. I don't really like the idea of knowing too much of what's happening. I get too comfortable, and then I feel like I need to run away. Which seems to be a theme in my life.
So what, when somebody starts to master this thing, you're going to turn all the rules upside down?
That's what happened exactly after that concert, because I realized I'd built this instrument. I spent, 6 hours a day training with it and learning how it behaves, because the memory system was intentionally complex. But because of that, I had to spend the time learning how it worked. And once I did, I was kind of like, okay, well, this is how it works. Now I know how it works. Now this is no fun. So
it takes you to an interesting part when you start talking about music and putting together sounds.
Yeah. I it was after this that I thought maybe I should actually learn how to play music, because maybe the idea of control for me has always been kind of a problem in music. I don't really see the point of it, but a lot of music is based on mastering things and having control over them.
So if anybody out there would like to volunteer, put your hands up to be the first conductor to play an Eran Sanadnadze piece, you'd have to be a sadist of some sort.
I mean, I'm happy to work with conductors as long as they're happy to work with me.
Or masochist, wouldn't it be?
Masochist.
You've got to get under that control. We're going to change all the rules.
Yeah. And I think we've had the rules. The rules have been set for a long time. They work in a lot of ways, but they can be everybody's rules. Some of us need to make up. We need to play a bit.
So this sounds to me like more than just an attitude towards music and sound.
I think it's the only place I can have this attitude, because I'm not particularly interested in ending up a political prisoner anywhere or starting any revolutions.
Oh, because, thank goodness.
Yeah, because they have actual consequences, and I really like having a comfortable life, but I don't like, I've always seen art as this kind of, not just an escape, but we can figure out systems that we aspire to and then work out whether they fit or not.
And push boundaries past where you might otherwise be able.
Yeah. Or the sacrifice of pushing those boundaries in other aspects of life are far greater. And I don't think anyone, unless they really want to, should have to do that. And I'm definitely too comfortable to do that elsewhere. So
this is a good way to explore a lot of things.
Yeah.
And to feed your curiosity, I think.
Yeah, and it's, you know, like a lot of, like when you read a book of any great author, you're immersed in a world that isn't there, but it's also there because it is in your mind at the time and you inhabit it, and that's enough and you can put it down and get back to your life.
I like the way you express that. Yes, that's good. That's very good.
Thank you. But music is very good.
Well, is it time for some more sound? What's
yeah,
up
I
next?
Think so. Yeah. Well, next is Iran Hair Sitari. Is that the complete title?
Yep. So the
I think that's the performers, isn't it?
I'll quickly introduce this piece. Me and a friend of mine from Iran, whose name is Setare, her and I grew up together. We're very close. She became a visual artist. I became a musician, and it actually started the other way around. I started playing music. She was playing music. I was a painter, and then we both kind of flipped. And we've been working together for years now, kind of exploring the same ideas, but in our weird attachment to our childhood in Iran. And this piece that was called Hair, that was a video of this animation of hair that she'd made, and the sound is the sound that I made for that.
Thank you.
And you're back with Songcatcher here on Radio Adelaide at 22 minutes past 9. And we're with our Songcatcher guest, Iran Sanadase.
That sounded pretty good pronunciation. But then again, Iran's already renowned for accepting almost any mispronunciation. I don't think she's heard mine yet.
Well, it's uncontrollable, isn't it?
Yeah. I've heard a lot of different versions over the years. It's okay. Uncomfortable.
We'll have to work on our Persian, won't we?
Well,
I think we should wind the clock back a little bit to get a bit of information about sort of where did this all come from? What music were you exposed to growing up? You've already talked about your brother being a drummer.
Yeah, there was a lot of music in my household, and it was always very polarized. We all managed to be quite harmonious with each other except for in our music tastes, and I was a diplomat, so I listened to everything and I said that all of it was not good. But
sucked, I think, is the vernacular.
Yeah. So I listened to a lot of Philip Glass and Stravinsky as a child, and a lot of Philip Glass, Stravinsky, and a lot of Arabic classical music, because my dad is a huge fan of the classical Arab singers like Abd el Halim Hafez and Umm Kulthum and Fairuz and those people. And the only Arabic I know is Abd el Halim's songs. That's all I know. So I can sing them to people, but I can't say hello. And then I listen to a lot of Metallica and Dream Theater as well on the side of that. And my own music taste outside of those things was just not particularly exciting. Just I listened to a lot of Björk when I was 14 and just angsty, which was, I think, appropriate. And yeah, that's...
Feed the angst.
Yeah, yeah.
But the art as well. So you came really originally, your preferred and chosen art form was visual art and painting.
Yeah. I had a sculpture teacher when I was quite young. I think I was 5 or 6 years old, who then became quite a famous sculptor in Iran. And I think even though I don't do any sculpture now, that was really integral to me getting into art, because she had a very weird studio and her art was strange, and she let us do anything we wanted, and it did become a lot of me playing with things, and I could work out space and color and those things. And then my room became the ultimate sculpture with things hanging off of everywhere, and my dad was not very happy, but he had the rule of you can do whatever you want, it is your room, it is yours. And then later on I got part of that whole my teen getting interested in sound was in visual art. Everything happens very instantly, or appreciation comes later, so the audience gets to spend the time and decide how time works. But I didn't know as a painter or as a sculptor how to deal with time. So when I first made music, all of it just happened in these block chords of lots of sound happening, all these massive, like, kind of Stravinsky-esque to some degree, but maybe more like Wagner, but bad Wagner.
But slowly along the way, you're starting to work time into your art form, I guess that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, time was the reason I wanted to kind of get into it. I was like, I need to work on this element. And then time led to space, which led to silence, which to me is still, there's still not enough silence in music. There just needs to be more. I'm never silent as a person, so I use music.
So, young folks, when you're practicing your music and your parents are yelling, shut up!
Yeah, that's...
Iran's on their side.
Yeah, for sure. I'm one of the loudest people amongst my friends, and I make some of the quietest music out of most of my musical friends. So I think you need to find your own opposite in your music.
Okay, the next piece we're going to play... It's the ocarina's part, and you were telling us before that you actually had these ocarinas made.
Yeah, I think, I don't know what happened, but I, being a very demanding friend, I asked another friend of mine, hey, can you make a couple of ocarinas for me? And then he made 12, and they all sounded different because he was not an ocarina maker. So then we decided to do a concert with them, and they don't sound right for an ocarina, but they sounded just right for me. So
we're going to have a sample.
Yeah, just
a
piece short
called Ocarinas.
Probably just a short edit.
We love the ocarinas.
That's a bit of a bonus track that we don't really have time for, but when we heard the story of the ocarinas being made for Iran, we had to have a sample. We're going to put about twice that amount into the podcast, so we won't fade what goes into the podcast. So you'll be able to listen to that again and more fully and properly.
I'm very excited. I haven't heard that them since the concert or until I was preparing to send them to you.
So you didn't have a hand in making the ocarinas?
No, I just demand a lot from all the people who are very nice to me. And
you'd be demanding a lot for me to make an ocarina, I can assure you.
Maybe you could persuade him to make a banjo and then Adrian would get excited about it.
I could probably make one of those Aboriginal clapping sticks, I reckon. I'd be probably good at that.
I don't know. They've got a particular tone.
They do have a particular tone. It's true. Mm. Mm. At least they almost look right. Anyway, we're going to talk about song next?
We seem to have.
Got two talk
do
about
we have two talk about
that's,
songs?
Well, we're lucky.
Oh, that's really exciting.
That's a bonus.
So perhaps the next piece we're going to play is listed as Iran Desert, and Steve-O plays Eric.
I did not give it this title. This was a concert of an Eric. It was an homage to Eric Satie.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. I love Eric Satie.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is good.
And this piece was an improvisation that was based on what me, Derek Pascoe, and Stephen Whittington all love about Satie and all of us coming together to perform a piece. And in this piece, all I do is to play feedback. So, you know, you've all heard feedback.
What do you mean by play feedback?
It was very tricky, this one. This was probably one of the trickier gigs that I think I've done, and we managed to pull it off, which was quite good, I think. So, you know, feedback obviously happens when you have a speaker and a microphone, and then there's a loop between them where sound goes and keeps getting amplified. So I set up some speakers and some microphones around what Derek Pascoe was playing on saxophone and in Stephen Whittington's piano. And I would try to cause feedback. So I was actually playing a mixer, like a mixing desk. So I would make feedback come on, but then I would use the equalizers on the mixer to tune the feedback and the different channels of feedback and then control its amplitude. And so, in a way, they were playing it for me, but I was retuning their feedback.
Now, I have a question for you. Do you know the Norse god Loki?
No.
He's responsible for all sorts of malevolence and nastiness. And feedback makes me think of, you know, he would be the god of feedback because he does those kind of nasty things to people that they don't want.
This was quite pleasant, to be honest, the performance of it, because, you know, it was Elder Hall, and in Elder Hall you cannot play loud music. And it's Eric Satie, so anything that's kind of... If there's any malice in Eric Satie, it's quite quiet and contained and comes out a lot later. So we tried to portray that, but
so the musicians were playing relatively quietly, but
they were playing quite loudly.
And the feedback, it was quiet as well.
The whole thing was, you know, within an average decibel range. It was just the content had a lot of sine waves in it.
Were you disappointed at that?
No, the problem with this is you can't have feedback unless you have a minimum amount of volume. So I had to accept that as a given for this one.
Okay, let's have a listen.
Thank you.
So, if you want to have a gig with a difference, you could have Iran come and be your sound engineer, and she would specialise in making sure you got the right amount of feedback everywhere that it should be.
I'm like here it. Whenever, if anyone needs me.
I like it.
So, tell us about the different reactions in the room, for starters, the sound engineer.
Yeah, the sound engineer wasn't happy, but I've known him for a while.
Are they ever happy?
Yeah, well,
their job not to be happy.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a pretty tough job because I appreciate that it's not very comfortable to have someone come and say, hey, you know that thing that everybody has a visceral reaction to? That's what I'm going to be doing for about 30, 40 minutes.
And what sort of reactions did you get from the audience?
This was actually, the feedback was really quiet in a lot of sections of this piece. And, you know, it's one of those things that if you're saying something uncomfortable, you might as well say it nicely so it gets through. So a lot of people were kind of, it's not obvious that it's feedback. Sometimes all that it does in some sections is that it slightly makes the tone of the saxophone and the piano murky and blend in together, so you can't quite hear where the harmonics are coming from, which I really like. That was my favorite bit. And there, in some sections, it would just kind of come out as one sine wave that faded up and down because you could kind of keep it in the mixer and bring it out. So the audience weren't too upset. There wasn't too much feedback.
Okay, then the next piece is called Parallel Lines.
I think this is a synthesizer-only piece. I've tried a lot of times to write music with just a laptop in front of me and, you know, some synthesizing software. And this has been one of the only ones which I haven't put in the bin. So I quite like it.
So what sort of a bin do you have?
You know, the virtual bin, the one with a kr sound.
It's got a kr sound.
That one.
And what have you made with this kr sound?
Nothing yet. Nothing
that's
yet.
Tomorrow's
it's copyrighted.
Project.
It's copyrighted. I'm not allowed.
Oh, we can make our own kr sound.
Yeah, there we go.
And then we can do all sorts of things with it, including feedback.
Including feedback, yes.
I wonder if you can get it through an ocarina.
I don't know why you couldn't get feedback.
So your musical skills, they're around synthesizer?
Yep. So I studied a sonic arts degree as my bachelor's degree, and that gives you a lot of sound art abilities or ideas, at least. And now I've played handbells for a few years now. So I play handbells and synthesizers. That's my musical ability.
That's kind of two ends of a spectrum that seem widely apart to my head.
I think handbells are, you know, the greatest communist instrument ever built, because you have to have 13 people and they make one instrument and everyone has to be on the same, you know, wavelength. So, and everyone has to keep together and the piece is bigger than all of you. And I just think it's the best place for communism is handbells.
And it's the ultimate ensemble piece.
Yeah, really. Absolutely.
So. But synthesizer, where did the skills to drive synthesizers come from?
It was the sound thing, because I, you know, when I decided to do music, I couldn't go and study piano because I had never practiced ever. So the sonic arts degree, they want weirdos like me that don't fit in anywhere.
And was it on principle that you didn't practice piano and
no,
stuff like that?
No, I was just, you know, very sociable as a teenager.
Was this part of you're coming to Adelaide, all of a sudden you can go out and party and do things?
Oh, no, I partied a lot in Iran, and then I came to Adelaide, and then I had no friends because I, you know, obviously didn't know anyone. And that move was quite big for me because a lot of stuff had happened in, like, my family's life beforehand. And then I moved from this very busy place, this, like, city of 15 million people that is a capital of a country with where I know the deep history and the contemporary politics of and all of those things, to somewhere that's very quiet and I don't know anything about and I don't know anyone. So my that space of the late years of my high school allowed me to, well, because I had to stop partying, then I would sit in my room and make music, and then the sound thing happened, and then the sound art happened.
Well, that's, I guess, partially a familiar story.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's happened with a lot of people. Yeah.
Shall we listen to Parallel Lines?
Thank you.
And you're back with Songcatcher, one of those wonderful programs that you hear only on Radio Adelaide, here on Community Radio, and it is now 9:48, encroaching on 10 o'clock.
And if you stop and think about it, Community Radio probably means you. So why don't you get on board and become a member? A member. You can become a member of Radio Adelaide.
Yeah.
First time ever a member.
Yeah.
That's even cooler than a member at the Adelaide Oval, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it's much better.
Yeah, much cooler. Yeah. Much more status.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so why don't you do
we're
it?
We're out of the rain as well.
And you're out of the rain. What a great idea.
Yeah.
And you can be anywhere, anytime. Tune in and say, hey, that's me. I'm part of this stuff. But right now, Songcatcher, Iran Sadadnadze.
Closer.
Yeah, oh, she's close. He's close.
Sadadnadze.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Anyway.
So the musicology part of your study at the moment, what does that involve?
So my PhD is about the sound quality of the Japanese koto, which is a zither, and it's about 1.8 meters tall. So what I do at the moment is looking at the acoustical properties of it and how come it sounds the way it does, and in that process trying to see, well, how does the wood affect the sound, how do the components affect the sound, and yeah, it's completely different from
now
all of
something. How different is it now? Is it a guzheng or something, the Chinese very similar equivalent?
It's quite similar to the guzheng. It's a descendant of one of the Chinese zithers.
Okay.
I think it might actually be the descendant of the guzheng.
Because I think you can learn guzheng in Munterstreet, just a few streets away.
Ah.
Yeah, there is
there is
a school of Chinese classical music.
Yeah. And there's a little shop that sells instruments as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's probably not such a little shop if it sells them.
Yeah.
Because they're quite big.
Yeah, absolutely. And the koto is like a hefty instrument.
It's big. So, the secrets of sound.
Yeah. So it's finally, now that I've gotten over my teen angst and all of that, and, you know.
We're going to have a show next up telling us how we can get over our teenage angst, because I reckon I'm ready for that kind of inside goss.
Yeah.
You do reach a point in life where you think, oh, might be about time.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's just I got too comfortable in music and making music, and I don't really – I mean, I've got a gig in a couple of weeks, and it's being in front of an audience that I have an issue with. I love the audience. We're all in it together, but I really don't like that power play with, like, someone on an elevated stage who is like, this is my sound now, listen to me, my ideas are now meant to be in your head kind of thing. And then I reach the point after this instrument that the dancers use and trying to kind of let go of that control that I needed just something else to think about, and then I went back to that sound and what is sound and how do things make sound.
So what are some of the secrets behind the sound of a koto?
From what I've found in the past few years, the elasticity of the wood makes a huge difference in everything. So the wood that the koto is made of is the Polonia wood, which is a very interesting and quite understudied wood. But because I'm not a material scientist, I'm only looking at the peripheral aspects of that wood.
Have you compared some of the notes that guitar makers and violin makers and people like that, how they describe their woods?
I read a lot of violin acoustics literature because, you know, there's been hundreds of years of studying the secrets of the Stradivarius and those kinds of things. And they know a lot about the violin.
Do you know a guy called Don Morrison in Adelaide?
No.
Well, I wonder if he could make an Australian koto out of a chook shed and what it would sound like.
He probably would make it if you just ask him.
Hey, Don.
He makes resonator guitars.
Ah, cool.
So resonator guitars, but the metal he uses, and sometimes, well, he often uses wood from, you know, for the necks, from things like railway sleepers and stuff like that, really old ones and aged. And he makes the guitar bodies typically out of old chook sheds.
That's really cool.
So you know, they come up with really interesting resonators and gorgeous ones with really old logos on, but I yeah, it could
be. And they have a history and they've had a whole different life.
They've had a whole different life.
Yeah.
That's an amazingly interesting concept. But we probably should move on because we're running way out of time.
We were going to make one before the end of the show.
We still got to talk about the gig as well.
Well, you know, we're going to do that after the next song. So this is Tarahan.
Yep.
And what can you tell us briefly about this one?
So the same person, the same visual artist that I've been working with, Setara, she had her first solo show in our home city in Tehran at the Tarahan Gallery. And she told me 2 weeks beforehand, I was like, oh, well, do you want someone to play at your closing? So I, you know, went not with my big instruments, just with my laptop. And I did a solo set that is inspired mostly about the fact, the thing for me is that Tehran to me sounds different from Adelaide. And I think the way a city sounds really affects how you hold yourself and how you walk around in it. And so it was a lot of me trying to explore my relationship to the city I'd left and how the city I'd gone to affected that relationship. And it was at that gallery. So, yeah.
Be able to hear all of Tarahan actually not even just all of the edit bit. I might put the whole lot on. It's about 12 to 16 minutes. I can't remember.
Cool.
So we'll put all of that onto the podcast. And it's an interesting listen. Now, we've got a couple of things to say before we get out of here.
Yes, we do. There's a gig.
Yeah, tell us about you're apparently playing as part of at Nexus Arts on July the 7th. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. So on the 7th, there are two pieces at the concert. The first one is the latest iteration of me and Setara's work. So her and I've made she made this video, this animation that's based on watercolor drawings that deal with objects and how we use objects when we're in confinement. That has a lot to do with our parents and their political history and the stories we grew up around and ourselves in quote-unquote exile. And the second part of the concert is a new piece commissioned by Nexus, which we'll be developing of the week of the gig. And that's with Rachel Johnston, Eriki Veltheim, and Parveen Singh. So, and that'll have my floors in it.
Okay, great. Well, that's coming up at Nexus. And remember, the Scala Firm competition's on at the moment, folks. If you're a songwriter and writing your own material, get an entry in for that. Thanks very much for coming in talking about your music, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Me too.
And stick around for Mixtape coming right up after this little musical break. We're going to have The Unravel.
Bye.